average, there's lots of published studies that show about 1 in 10 nurses, anesthesia providers, and pharmacists will divert narcotics at some point in their career. And just to give a sense of things, we have found over 800 confirmed cases just in the last quarter at the hospitals, and that's confirmed cases of diversion. We know that there's more beyond that. Many of the health systems do see this as a mental health and well-being challenge and are trying to catch things earlier and find behavior earlier to help the providers get on the right track and get the help that they need.
Welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, where you can learn from entrepreneurs and investors who are driving progress in healthcare and life science around the globe. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alex Merwin from AWS. Prescription drug spending reached $370 billion in the U.S. last year, but up to 10% of that is lost to diversion, waste, and non-compliance. On this episode of the AWS Health Innovation Podcast, I'm excited to speak with Kevin McDonald, CEO and co-founder of BlueSight, who is helping hospitals rein in drug spending by providing software to optimize their pharmacies from sourcing to utilization. By connecting data at every point between medication manufacturing and clinicians administering drugs, BlueSight customers gain unprecedented visibility into their supply chains. This reduces waste, ensures compliance, and, most importantly, detects drug diversion to protect patients and providers. Kevin will share how BlueSight is transforming hospital operations and discuss their vision for an intelligence-based pharmacy operating system. Here we go. Kevin McDonald, the CEO and co-founder of BlueSight, welcome to the AWS Health Innovation Podcast.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So where are you dialing in from, Kevin?
I'm in Miami. It's a wonderful place to be this time of year.
I am in London. It's a less nice place to be this time of year, although it's a jet blue sky right now. It's beautiful and crisp. What's the weather like in Miami? Probably blue and warm.
It's actually a little cloudy today. It's been unusually cloudy for the winter here.
Okay. And Kevin, we're going to learn a little bit more about BlueSight and what you all do, but maybe before we do that, how's your week gone? But what have you been working on and what's the latest?
We've been working on a whole bunch of things here at BlueSight. We've been trying to get our product roadmaps in line for 2024, seal up the budget. JP Morgan Healthcare Week was last week, visiting with partners and other industry players. And actually, we're on an AWS Healthcare podcast. We're in the middle of migrating a data center as well. And so working with migrating that data center to AWS.
That's great. We're all about doing anything we can to reduce technical hurdles and just get solutions to clinical impact faster. I always joke with people that this time of year, it's Q5, because you go through the sprint to finish the year, and then it just keeps carrying across because you've got JPM, early conferences, planning, goal setting, and then probably getting ready for your next board meeting. So that's just the nature of it. Maybe for our listeners who are less familiar, can you briefly describe what BlueSight does and the main problem that it aims to solve?
Sure. Happy to. So BlueSight, we help the health system pharmacy, primarily in the U.S., do basically three things. Help them save money on drugs, help them be safer and more compliant, particularly around opioids and what's called diversion. So people stealing or using drugs, narcotics primarily in the hospitals, and then also tracking medications using RFID technology. So overall, what our goal is help provide a software platform so that health system pharmacy can do their job better and spend more time on clinical work. Most pharmacists in the U.S. go to school for 6 years, and a lot of them then do 2 years worth of residency and spend very little time on things like supply chain, yet are immediately forced to go into what's really the most sophisticated supply chain I've seen and most challenging supply chain inside the health system itself, where you have all sorts of different ways medications flow, different types of urgency, different types of concerns around control and or refrigeration, mixing, packaging. So it's a really interesting challenge, and helping that pharmacist actually be able to do the clinical care they're trying to do is our mission.
So can we speak a little bit more about drug diversion? What are some of the biggest drivers for why that happens, and what's the impact on patients and clinicians, right? Because The patients need the drugs, but obviously clinicians that are diverting drugs as well are likely suffering with their own challenges as well, right? Addiction or mental health or otherwise. So there's the tracking of the diversion as it happens, but now how do you equip the pharmacy to manage the diversion itself, but then stop it earlier and help give these people the support that they need to limit it from happening in the first place?
Yeah, diversion, just to level set, it is a huge problem inside the health systems. On average, there's lots of published studies that show about 1 in 10 nurses, anesthesia providers, and pharmacists will divert narcotics at some point in their career. And just to give a sense of things, we have found over 800 confirmed cases just in the last quarter at the hospitals. And that's confirmed cases of diversion. We know that there's more beyond that. And I will get into some of the details there. But in terms of diversion and how it happens, there's all sorts of different patterns. So what we're doing at the end of the day is taking data from systems that the hospital has. So they've got the electronic medical record. They have these things that are vending machines for drugs that are called dispensing cabinets. So we take data feeds off of those, take data feeds from their HR systems, from their where they're buying the drugs in the first place, the drug wholesalers, and then applying a number of different analytics, AI, machine learning to figure out what's unusual and what's unusual for the individual provider, for your department, for your facility, and start to create a risk profile and then figure out who is showing the biggest types of risk. There are mental health challenges that certainly lead to it, but sometimes it's things as simple as anesthesia providers, you know, go on coffee and they, you know, throw out an ankle or a knee and figure, hey, look, I'm hurting a little bit. Let me just take a little bit and accidentally miss dose and then get on a train there. Sometimes it is for profit that they're selling. Some of the largest cases in pharmacy where there's basically wholesale after resale of narcotics. And then the nurses as well, all sorts of reasons why folks end up diverting and potentially using the drugs over time.
I'm thinking about the broader theme of physician burnout and overwork and the challenging environment that many healthcare professionals find themselves in. And obviously you're attacking this problem from a very narrow perspective of let's just give the health system good data so they know that diversion's happening. But hopefully with that baseline, if you're running operations within a big hospital network or a pharmacy network, that gives you something you can work with, right? Over time, maybe if you have these confirmed cases, you can get more budget for wellness programs, things like that. Have any of your customers done that yet? Or do you think that would be down the road?
A lot of them do. They actually have programs around wellness and prevention and mental health treatment. Many of the health systems do see this as a mental health and well-being challenge and are trying to catch things earlier and find behavior earlier to help the providers get on the right track and get the help that they need rather than just a sort of law enforcement angle to it. There are some folks that take that angle to it and at some level things that they progress eventually end up there, but there is a big push amongst a large number of health systems to try to get ahead and help the providers that are starting to go down that road and help them get on the right path.
You pull in these different data streams and you identify a baseline for what normal looks like. And if there's variance from the baseline, then you'll throw up an alert and get people to go and go look into it and identify the diversion cases. So how do you develop that baseline? Do you just integrate and stay active for a week or two? Do you have your customers input exactly how much medications they're dispersing? Are you able to pull in a baseline from a similar health system? Can you speak to how you're able to identify the anomalous activity and the diversions from baseline? Not to reuse the term, but
yeah, sure. And let me maybe share another both DEA regulation and something that we do, which is auditing of controlled substances. So the DEA requires hospitals to track every single narcotic that they purchase. What did they do with it? So did they use it? If you didn't use it, you have to account for the waste. And where did it go? So the very first thing we're doing is taking these data systems and trying to create a story of each narcotic that goes through the health system. And by the way, it's beyond narcotics. The health system can flag anything that they're interested in. Sometimes they're not on the C2 register. Sometimes it's like just expensive drugs they're trying to track as well. But we create a picture of what is the history of this medication and where things don't line up, we flag variances that the health system can give reasons for. Oh, someone forgot to document something, someone dropped a vial, someone handed it off to somewhere else, so it's actually documented over here, those kinds of things. So very foundational baseline is the history of every medication. Then what we do is we look at a number of vectors depending on what type of provider you are. And there can be literally hundreds of vectors. Mm. And we do look at nationwide trends, but then we start to develop for each person and for each department, for each health system, a view of what's normal. So let me give one example. So if you're on the fourth floor of a particular facility, you may take a certain amount of time to get to a certain room, and perhaps that amount of time is wildly different than your peers, and or maybe your own time to go from point A to point B has increased over time. And we know that because the time it took for you to dispense it from the vending machine and then administer it to the patient. So just understanding some trending helps us determine what's unusual relative to everyone else in your department or in your facility. And there's literally hundreds of those types of things that we look at and then trend over time. So there's AI models that basically work up.
Wow, that's a very nuanced and detailed view. Kevin, I want to learn a little bit more about you. So let's take a step back. Why do you have such a nuanced and detailed view of the world? How did you get to founding this company? What drove your inspiration? We have a lot of founders that listen to the show, so I think it's always interesting to hear about that 0-1 story. Why'd you do something as crazy as founding a health tech startup, tackling diversion?
It is a crazy thing, and I'm not totally sure if everything that I was involved that I would have done it again, but it's fun to be here. I had a really fun job at Sun Micro where I was basically there to learn new technologies and then talk to their top 100 customers about those new technologies. One of those technologies was radio frequency ID or RFID technology, which was really in its infancy back then. And this was very early 2000s. Both the FDA and Walmart were putting mandates out to put RFID tags on things. So I worked with things like Viagra and OxyContin on the pharma side, and we worked with all sorts of consumer packaged goods on the Walmart side. At that time, both mandates ended up failing, and they failed for the same reason. They failed because there wasn't an ROI, there wasn't a real driver around why to use the technology. So the manufacturers all saw it as a cost without any real benefit. So I ended up leaving Sun and I joined a consulting company that did RFID projects. Like any good consultant, you start to understand what's a good or bad use of the technology and develop a checklist. And I ended up in all sorts of different supply chains, everything from Colombian weapons, Egyptian airports, aerospace, oil and gas, consumer packaged goods. And then in the healthcare space, you ended up in pharma and pharma distribution. You very quickly see that the US healthcare drug distribution is the most screwed up of all the supply chains. And there's so many strange things that go on. So I felt like, hey, this is a big problem area. It's really gnarly. At the same time, what I saw was going back to those mandates. On the retail side, what happened was we were working with a couple of retailers. And let me use an example of if you walk into Nordstrom. So if you go to buy shoes at Nordstrom, you sit down, you see the regular shoe and you say, hey, I want a size 12 of that shoe. And then someone goes in the back and gets size 12, put it on. If that shoe's not on the display, from you consumer's perspective, that shoe doesn't exist. Mm. And what the retailers found was that if you put an RFID tag on the display shoe, on actually every shoe that could potentially be on the display, then you could actually drive 30 or 40% higher sales of those shoes because you would know they'd always be on display. So here you had a situation where you were driving a reason to not just tag at the pallet and case level like Walmart was originally looking at, but actually go down to the item level because you were driving business results. And that was a really important insight. And then when we eventually, I was talking to a friend of my wife who is a pharmacist. She was starting to describe this situation where You had these trays of medications that they had to hand check using a pharmacist. Took all kinds of time. It required two people to check. You know, really expensive drugs, really highly critical items, really clunky processes. This is a similar sort of situation where instead of looking at like a case or pallet level, if we actually go down to the individual vial, there's a lot of value to be driven in terms of accurately processing, being able to relieve the very expensive labor, be able to reduce expiration and reduce waste. And it was from that that I ended up starting. Going from there, I started just cold calling hospitals. And this is probably the piece where if I knew what I knew today, I don't know that I want to go. I'm quite there. But having sold to big pharma and large banks and all these Fortune 500 companies, I figured, hey, what other industry has a 9 or 10 figure revenue business in every city in the country? So it seemed like it was just huge target set. Hospitals are really challenging to sell to, but I started calling hospitals and eventually found a hospital that was willing to take a try. Called up my co-founder, Tim, and said, hey, what do you think? I can't believe people are doing this manually. We started the company. So,
Kevin, I'm always really interested in the early day stories. I want to talk a little later about a few of your customer wins and, you know, how this is having an impact. But it's really easy once you've, it's never easy, but it's easier once you have product market fit and you're in growth stage. And now the challenges are around scaling and go-to-market access. But at the early days, even knowing if you have product market fit is so difficult. And many startups pivot. You got to make experiments. It's really difficult to know, do I just need to tweak this one thing? Have we not tried everything right? Or to have the conviction to say, no, we're on the wrong path. We need to make a change. So can you tell a story or two about those early days? And this could be like a challenging product development problem that you had. It could have been a challenging deployment environment with the customer, but any stories you can tell about when you were trying to find product market fit, that would be really insightful.
Yeah, I'd say the biggest thing was around budget. All that worked. And to this day, there's three things that I think prevent people from buying stuff anywhere, but in particular in hospitals. And those three things are legal, IT, and budget. And we really strove to, on the tech side for what's known as KitCheck, architect a solution that didn't require any IT involvement. Given that you have an RFID scanning station at the hospital, it's like, how do you do this in such a way that I don't require and install software, I can plug it into the network and go. From a legal perspective, it's like, how do you make that contract as simple and small as possible? Mm-hmm. But the biggest learning was around budget. So we ended up changing the business model a number of times before we finally hit on it. And originally what we were doing was charging for the solution, kind of upfront, so like big upfront, and then add a subscription and then purchase some consumables. But we tried to just like pure subscription. We tried a few things. We actually, funny news, we've now gone back to pure subscription. But what we learned, particularly early days, was that these health system pharmacies, and we were primarily dealing with academic medical centers at the time because they're the early adopters, they have a huge drug budget. And the decision maker, who's the head of pharmacy, can spend more or less unlimited dollars on drugs and supplies, but they have a hard time buying a laptop because it has to go through the same budget cycle purchasing an electronic medical record is. It's hard to rise up and be prioritized in that world. So we ended up switching the business model while we were at Rock Health in San Francisco to a per tag transactional model. And that really opened up the market for us. Almost overnight, we went from two hospitals and a really long, difficult sales cycle to five more bought right away. And that was wonderful, right? Because it felt like we had unlocked something. The challenge is I had been self-funding that until that point. And the influx of new customers in that model means that you've got to grunt all the cash to do it. It's taking money out of my home equity line and credit cards and things like that. So it's like, oh, we are not going to be able to bootstrap this. We're going to have to go raise capital. So that was a pretty important piece. One other crazy story that I'll tell early days. So we had the first hospital go live, which is University of Maryland, and a couple of crazy stories. One, we hadn't tested on drugs ahead of time because we were working out of our apartments. So I was using tonic water and Starbucks Frappuccinos to be proxies for drugs. So we didn't really know if it was going to work until we went on site. And when we did our first scan of a kit, buyer walks in and says, "Hey, you want to see the scan?" And I hadn't slept the night before because I had no idea if there was going to be a problem when we actually got to do it. Hit the button and sure enough, it worked. And it's like,
eureka.
Relief. But then you get a little bit later and our second customer, which is NYU. And as we were flying out to Rock Hill, Hurricane Sandy was just starting. And we fly out to Rock Hill, we land, we're at the hotel and we're looking at the television screen. And NYU is betaing us at the time. And we look at the screen and they're evacuating NYU. So it's like, of all the hospitals in the country that are going to have a problem, why does it need to be our second hospital? Now, they're a great partner to this day. And they called us up and they said, "Hey, when we go and reopen, we want to reopen with you guys." So it ended up being a great story. But boy, really stressful time there.
Oh, yeah. That must have been brutal. At Amazon, we're very customer obsessed and we encourage working backwards from a customer's expressed needs. But people often interpret that as a job to be done. You can apply a very product-focused lens to that, but what you're describing is you really had to get attuned to the customer's purchasing behavior as well. So it's not just, what does this thing do? It's also, how am I going to fund the purchasing of it? And the way that you aligned the solution to the purchasing behavior makes a lot of sense. But I think I missed the direct connection there. Can you tie it up for me? And so you switched to the per tag pricing. And you mentioned that these academic medical centers, they had a very high amount of budget for drugs. Did that enable the procurement to be communicated internally as a drug plus cost so they could put it in on the drug line item?
Yeah, exactly. So the RFID tags were effectively deemed a supply, so they could just buy it like any other drug or supply. And we actually end up in a bunch of situations, we distribute the tags through the drug wholesalers so they can just buy some propofol and buy some RFID tags and get them all in the same tote. Really streamlined it so that it all came in one place. So that was super important early on.
I also wanted to talk to you about your fundraising journey, and you hinted to it there that these things never work out cleanly. Hindsight 2020, you're always journeying through the dark jungle and just trying to figure it out, slashing your machete around. But can you tell us a little bit about, you mentioned you bootstrapped for a while and then you raised capital at the point when you found better solution fit. Can you tell us about the fundraising journey? How was bootstrapping? Would you do it again that way? Do you think you'd raise venture capital earlier? Just any general reflections you have, knowing that we have founders who listen to the show.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have totally gone into it intending to bootstrap all the way, but I think it was a good mindset. And I do, when I meet other founders, it's really important that you're willing to jump 100% in and quit your other job and really go into it, because if you don't fully believe in yourself and you're not fully committed to it, why should someone commit their money to it? I see that time and time again. I was fully in. I was fully invested. All of my net worth was tied up in it. By the time we actually ended up doing venture capital, perhaps we should have done it a little earlier, but the further along you get, the better terms and valuation you have. So we raised our Series A in 2013, Newleaf Ventures was our lead. And it was a tough process. We talked to more than 40 VCs. And over that time, we got a few term sheets, but ended up taking the term sheet from Billy. As we continued to grow, we took our two follow-on rounds of fundraising, and we did raise some debt as well. The purposes of that were just to grow out the commercial team, grow out the organization, add additional products, which we've since added two additional products. We actually had one product failure along the way. That was a really tough time for the company where we launched something, we had to kill the product. It just unfortunately didn't fit a market need in the way that we needed it to fit the market need. And then in July, we took a private equity round from Thoma Bravo and are on the next chapter of growth. We at the same time announced that we acquired Medassist, and we're excited to see what's next as we build out this medication intelligence platform in a bigger way.
That's a great story. You've taken on capital from a diverse range of sources, so that really provides some good insight. Can you talk a little bit more about that bet you made? You mentioned that you made a bet on a product that it didn't work out. How do you think about risk-taking as an entrepreneur, and how do you communicate risk to your team? Would you take that risk again? Obviously, you've got to put chips on the table, and sometimes the house is going to sweep them away. Would you redo that, or how do you think about risk-taking?
Oh, I think you have to use your term, put chips on the table and take risks in doing new products. What we probably should have done is a little more upfront market research. What we learned was that anesthesia providers, just at the end of the day, don't want anything to be changed in their workflow. And that became something that we couldn't overcome. Now, out of that product, we found what now is Control Check, the diversion product. So the good news is we made something out of it. It is important to really do some research, do it quickly, and ideally fail fast. We did not fail fast enough. I think we let it go a little bit too long before we killed it. And sometimes when it fails, you get some good things out of it, which we certainly did by having the diversion product out of it. But yeah, you always got to be looking at things. As you scale, it becomes trickier to do completely new products just because the development life cycle is so long. And having milestones for when can we have proof points and what's working or not are really important pieces along the way.
Yeah. So I think there's a kernel of wisdom in there, though, because you said it. You wanted to fail fast, right? Real failure is when it's titrated out over time and diverting focus, diverting resource. Previous to Amazon, I worked in startups and we launched a product that was a big bet. It was a video advertising company. We launched a product to help people skip video ads because everybody hates video ads. But that pretty much undermined the core business model. And so it was a big bet, but our leadership team just diverted all product dev to make a very robust solution. It took us 3 or 4 months to do it. We got it out of market and it didn't work. And 9 months after, we knew we needed to go in a different direction. But I'll frequently encounter leaders who it feels reasonable to take a rationed approach, but sometimes that can be the worst thing you can do. Just don't do it until you have the resources to commit to doing it fully. And then failing fast is a great outcome. And then you mentioned you could have failed quicker, which of course we can always improve over time. But the fact you've been able to apply those learnings into a new, solution area, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think everyone learned a lot from that and we continue to learn over time. So
Kevin, I want to hear about your customers. I mentioned earlier, I wanted to talk about your customers and then you just kept saying interesting things, but we kept getting diverted to other interesting topics, but we've gone too long. So tell me about, and I dare say the word favorite, because they're all your favorite, but tell us about a few customer stories of really great partners that when you founded this company, you saw a vision for the future that was really different than the way things were being done. So there will surely be partners you work with that go more all in than others, right? Because you need to keep the lights on and generate revenue. But are there a few customer stories that you just think are exemplar examples of pharmacies just really changing the way they operate using your technology?
When I first dialed in was cold calling. I remember my pitch as I was cold calling to folks was, what if you could check a crash cart in 20 seconds? And pretty consistently, I heard that would be amazing, but it's impossible. And I got to give Mark Summerfield, who was director of pharmacy at University of Maryland at the time, credit for taking a risk on Tim and I and putting it in. And it felt really good when it was running for him to say, look, I'm hearing from across the street that this thing out of the gate is a big win. And when I occasionally go to trade shows and I hear from customers who are users alike, I was at ESHP, which is the American Society for Health System Pharmacists, in December, and a customer came up and said, it's my favorite piece of technology. It makes the biggest difference for us in terms of time savings and helping us do more work. Like, that was really touching. And then on the diversion side, hearing folks say that if I have a state board of pharmacy come in and ask a question, I can immediately provide that audit trail. It seems trivial, but this is something that used to take people days or weeks, or they were ending up with an auditor in a world where they weren't able to answer a question, which is not a great place to be. We've heard situations like we were talking about earlier where people say, hey, look, we are catching diversion. In fact, there was a study that was published in the American Journal of Health System Pharmacy that shows that we're catching diverters more than 100 days earlier, which means you can take action to help that person get on the right track. Without us, oftentimes the way people catch diversion is just someone looks drunk or stoned in a hallway, which is things have gone really bad. So it's really meaningful when you hear these stories. We were able to help these providers. And then on the cost saving side, a hospital in California that they said, hey, look, plugged it in and immediately saved several million dollars. And because of that, we can do more with our drug budget and we can do more with our pharmacy.
There's so much that I love in that response. And just to comment on a few themes, Kevin, does your team ever come to you and say, hey, we want to get together. We want to do a team building thing. We want to do a strategy planning summit. As a team leader, you're asked to do these things and frequently you just don't have the time to do them. And so when you make statements like, we took the audit from taking weeks to being available on demand, think about what that unlocks for the individual on the other side of that audit, right? Because within these teams, it's the exact same kind of dynamic, right? And how do we actually make a change in these providers' day-to-day lived work experience to enable them to create strong cohesive cultures and drive innovation in other areas of their work and practice? And it's through stuff like that. It's not just a week, right? Just think about what people can do with that much time. And then on the patient side, I just want to call out there, I don't know if you've listened to this, but Serial Productions did a podcast called The Retrievals, which is about diversion occurring in anesthesia for in vitro fertilization and IVF retrievals. And it's a gut-wrenching investigation, not just of diversion, but of paternalism in healthcare and a minimization of women reporting symptoms by healthcare providers. And I'd encourage everybody to go listen to it. But being able to decrease the time of spotting a diversion by 100 days, think about some patients could be impacted in that 100-day period. And forget about your CMS quality star score and just think about the human impact on the other side of the table. And that's just really startling. Let's go back to the commercial side, if you don't mind. So you mentioned that you initially were just cold calling hospitals. You know, how's your go-to-market approach changed over time? We talked a little bit about the business model, but more in terms of your commercial organization, right? So as you got that solution fit and you dialed up, get really nitty gritty and imagine if you are like a Series A backed health tech startup that has product market fit and you just rose your A and now you need to hire like a VP of sales and you're thinking about scaling your go-to-market to sell into hospitals. How did you think about segmenting the market? Did you hire a few more junior reps to work through a Rolodex first, or did you hire somebody more senior to create the strategy? How did your go-to-market approach and staffing change over time?
Our very first hire was actually a pharmacist who could sell. And we dabbled for a little bit with the channel model. In my experience, particularly when you're early with a product, trying to do a channel is very difficult because if you don't know how to sell it and what the sales process is, it's really hard to get someone else to do that unless it's like an absolute requirement for their product. And it's also really hard to get their sales reps motivated to sell it versus other things that they know about selling. So we first hired a pharmacist who could help sell. He brought in some really talented folks, built out a direct team. And we've had flavors of a direct team over time that primarily been geographically focused. And of course, there's prioritization by larger health systems and larger hospitals and work from there. We've over time built out a marketing function, which does lead gen, product marketing, website, of course, trade shows and others. And then we've brought in some business development reps that can help nurture leads, generate additional leads. And then we've built out customer success as well to support those customers that are already up and running and keep them happy and make sure that they understand what's happening from a business side. And then over time, of course, you get more word of mouth and it builds on itself. So today, the commercial organization is much larger than it was, obviously, when it was Tim and I, or when we hired our first salesperson or even built up that initial team, four or five different reps.
That's really good insight. So what's your ambition for the next few years? What do you want to see from the team and what do you have planned?
Yeah, look, over the next couple of years, we'll probably double or triple the business through a combination of continuing to grow the pieces and platforms that we have, tie them together. We already are tying them together in more of an enterprise approach, but doing more things where one product adds value in the other. So one example of that, KITS, we can tell you how much inventory costs you have on hand and what's the precise amount that you're wasting, because the cost information we have as well. And there's all sorts of opportunities to do more of that. We'll end up both building and buying additional pieces. And the idea is to become that system for the health system pharmacy that provides the software that they need to do their job across financial, operational, and compliance areas. So we'll see more solutions that cover each of those and that cover across.
Any plans for international expansion?
Not at the moment. I certainly won't rule it out, but the U.S. healthcare system is very different and very large. So I feel like our opportunity in the U.S. to expand is so big. It's cheaper and easier to expand in the U.S. before we really go far overseas. In a past life, we went overseas really early, and it can be fun and exciting to go overseas, but it also is oftentimes a whole different set of challenges, a whole different set of buyers. That healthcare in particular, the way the healthcare systems work are so different that you almost have to rethink the market. And let me just give a couple of anecdotes. In Europe, for pharmacy at least, it's not, you can't really have a Europe strategy. It's more like a Germany strategy, a France strategy, a UK strategy. Whereas in the US, I can run a US-wide single go-to-market strategy and things like that. Being able to just do Germany, just do France, just do UK public, UK private, it's almost like building out a different go-to-market motion for each individual state, which is a little bit too complicated.
Kevin, when we wrap up today and you think back on our conversation, it's the end of the day for me here in London. We're recording this on a Friday, so I'm looking forward to the weekend, and you'll be there too, just a little bit further behind me thanks to the physics of it. But when you're having dinner tonight and you think back on this conversation, you're like, that was really interesting. We touched on all this stuff. But what's the one thing you're going to wish that I had asked you that we didn't cover?
I'd go back to not just like product market fit, but like really making the buying experience as easy and installation experience as easy as possible. So again, like we focus every product on how do you cut down the legal paperwork? How do you cut down the IT involvement? And how do you cut down the barriers to budget? And that doesn't mean that you need to make it cheaper. Like, how do you work with the systems that are already there? Because there's a lot of money in healthcare, but it's oftentimes hard to get it. Really focusing around those things, I think, are as important as the like product itself. Like the way that the product fits into the market is through the lens of those things.
Oh, that's such a critical insight. And there's such a strong intuition to cut prices when you see lack of acceleration in the pipeline. I don't want to say commercial traction, because what you see is deal delays. Now, they said they're going to say yes and they delayed it. So you see stalled pipeline, and the craving is to discount. If anything, you might need to charge more and focus on the procurement pathway. Because, and I say that because we're going to see, unfortunately, many companies not make it and need to consolidate and flow into each other. And it's just because it's way more expensive than any of us planned. And making sure you don't compromise on that, knowing it's difficult to increase rates later, and just focus on how are people actually going to procure this, that I think that is really important. Kevin McDonald, the co-founder and CEO of BlueSight, what a fun conversation. We haven't gone deep on pharmacy yet on the podcast, so I'm really glad that we did this. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for joining us today for the AWS Health Innovation Podcast. If you want to get in touch with AWS, please check out our show notes where you can find a link. If you enjoy the podcast, the best way to support us is to share it with your colleagues and friends. We also really appreciate your reviews and ratings wherever you listen to podcasts. We love hearing feedback from our listeners, so please don't hesitate to get in touch. Again, you'll find all the details in our show notes. See you next week.